You're at the Coaching Inn, 3D Coaching's virtual pub, where we enjoy conversations with people who are engaged in the world of coaching.
Hello, and welcome to the 3D Book Group, where we read a book together, where we ask questions and share insights on social media, and most importantly, get to engage with the author. More of that later. I'm Claire Pedrick, and our book for this season is The Art of Enough by Becky Hall. And as it says on the cover, in a world full of pressure to be more, do more, and consume more, this practical guidebook will help you find your own version of enough. Enough is a springboard for self-belief, a healthy work pace, and sustainable living so you can move from striving to thriving. So really useful for all of us and very useful for coaches. So Becky, tell us a bit about you and your human bit, and then we'll find out a bit more about you and the book bit.
Okay. Well, the human me lives in Oxford in the UK. I live with my partner and our two children and a dog and two cats. And I am currently in my garden office, for which I am supremely grateful, because I had it built in about 2017, not foreseeing the global pandemic, but it is the thing, that the space that has allowed me to continue working and writing. In fact, so I'm very blessed to have it. So I'm a coach. I've been a coach for a long time. I actually originally trained as an actor and worked as an actor in my 20s for 8 or 9 years, and then hit 30 and thought, I might need something that's a little bit more stable and lucrative and just a bit more sort of self, you can have a bit more agency when you're not at the mercy of casting directors and things. So I did a master's in adult learning and got into facilitating and group dynamics and people, working with people and teams. And from that, I developed a facilitation practice, and then that became also a coaching practice. So that's what I've been doing for the last long time, over 20 years now.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And where did the book come from?
Well, that's a really great question. The book is, I think it's a hybrid of my own life experience and what I've noticed as a coach. So I had the idea actually about 7.5 years ago. I began to really notice some patterns in my coaching, which was that lots of people I was coaching were saying in their own different ways that they didn't feel that they were enough of something. So there was this sort of, you could call it for some people it's imposter syndrome. That's not what it is for everybody, but people who are really doing well in their lives who just don't feel that they're enough, good enough, whatever enough. So then that became, I was really curious about that. And then a lot of people that I was coaching also were just massively struggling with having too much to do. The overwhelm, the culture that we live in where there's always more to do, and exacerbated by email and just busy, complexity, volume, but really too much. And then, of course, we live in the climate crisis is there. And so we're all sort of grappling with how we can best respond to that. And it seemed to me that the sort of central theme, or the theme that combined all of these things, is this idea of enough, that we really are ambivalent about this idea of living within healthy limits, or that we strive to be enough and then we have too much to do and we have too much. And, you know, this idea of enough really could be really explored. So I had the idea, as I said, 7.5 years ago, and then set myself the task to write it in 2020. Luckily, before the globe, but before COVID, before we'd even really heard of COVID, I was like, I'm either going to write this book or I'm going to stop talking about writing this book. So that's why so I'm very fortunate actually, because I plotted it all out and did lots of work on structure so that when the pandemic did come and actually released a bit of time for me, I was able to to progress it without sort of worrying or panicking that what I was going to do.
Wow. And what's your dream for it? Now it's gone out and it's got its own life.
It's a lovely question. I do feel like it's like a sort of child that's left home now. So my dream is that it lands in the hands of people that it will serve. That sounds very worthy, but it really is my dream. It really is my dream that it would land, that people will read it and find something useful in it for them. And it's really broad, you know, it's got so much, you know, it could be, if it lands with some people who are struggling with not feeling enough of whatever it is, then brilliant. I hope that they find something in it. I hope that it finds some people who have too much to do can use it, and you know, that it's practical. But also there's a sort of philosophical element to it, which is about, you know, how we can all reframe how we live. And of course, my biggest dream for it is that it will help us as a society and as a culture to sort of really begin to rethink how we live so that we can live sustainably.
And it's interesting, isn't it, that dream that you had 7.5 years ago was for now.
Yeah. I mean, it really is interesting, that thing about books, because I've tried to write this book so many times. You know, like 7 years ago, I was right, I'm going to write it now. And I could never find the time, or I never made the time. And then I was going to do it with a friend and then another friend. And we sort of had this, I knew the idea was one that was right, but it just didn't quite find its way into the world. And now it has. It seems to be, gosh, what a relevant topic for now, as people are coming back from lockdown life and beginning to work out how to live hybrid working lives and rethinking their relationship with work, rethinking, we're absolutely, essentially, really properly thinking about how we live sustainably after COP26. And it's a very it's very current. The what I realized about the book now is that it's not just for people my age. You know, I'm in my 50s, you know, and lots of people I work with are at sort of senior levels in their organization. So almost by default are in their sort of 40s or 50s. But actually, loads of younger people that I've spoken to about the book, it really resonates with them. So it's actually in lots of ways quite a millennial book. And so it seems like the right book. I'm glad it's landed now. I think it feels like it's time.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. So I'm just going to give you a bit of an overview about how the whole book group works, and then we'll pop you in breakouts to respond, really, and to think about what insights you've had from what Becky said and what questions you've got for her today, really. So the way it works is that every week on social media, Rebbie will put out some questions about each chapter. So she'll say, this week we're looking at chapter one, and that's an opportunity for you to pop in on any of our social media channels, LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. You can put in your insights and your questions. We'll gather those together and give them to Becky, and then Becky will record a podcast responding to what you're saying, your insights and your questions. And then that will go out the next week, and then we'll move on to the next chapter. And what we did when we did it with Simplifying Coaching, which was huge fun, was to have a live one at the end where some of the people who've been reading the book might want to come in and have a chat to Becky about the impact it's had on them. And that will happen some weeks or months into the future. So the engagement after today will be on social media and through listening to Becky responding to your insights and questions, which makes it really relevant and really relevant to you. But we don't meet face to face again. So that's the kind of structure.
Fascinating listening to everybody and seeing how COVID had actually brought us all, had affected us all. And actually this, like you said, I think, Becky, how pertinent and how timely this really is. Because I think for a lot of us, it brought us up short and thought, well, why are we doing this and how can we do it differently? So I think we've all come here with a sort of personal agenda, I suppose, of trying to find out more how we can find that balance.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that's a good thing that you're in the right place to be thinking about the stuff that matters. I read some article, I think it was Arianna Huffington had posted it on her stuff around it, what are they calling it? The Great
Reset.
Reset.
It's the Great Reset. No, everyone leaving.
The Great Resignation.
Yeah, and she was reframing it as the Great Reset. Absolutely. So that people are resigning because they've realised that there's something not quite right in their lives, or that their balance of life isn't quite right, or that they could be doing something that matters more to them. And it's all very much of in that space that this book sort of offers a frame to explore, I think.
So I've just begun to look at it.
Great.
And just begun to look at your blog. Mm. And my first question, if I may, it was more of an observation. I was really interested in the title, The Art of Enough. I was quite drawn to that. I'd love to know how you came to that title.
Yeah, great. Lovely question. Thank you. And I'm glad you've asked that question, because the title was a real thing for me in relation to deciding which publisher I went with, because I had one publisher who liked the idea of the book but didn't like the title, and I had one publisher who loved the title, and I had to decide how much I liked it or not. I think the title sort of came to me at the same time as the concept of the book came to me, which was about 7 or 8 years ago. I began to really notice some patterns in my coaching. And one of the patterns was that lots and lots of people I was coaching and working with were talking about sensing a feeling of inadequacy, or somehow lacking something, that they somehow in different ways weren't enough for what life was requiring of them.
This didn't come out of the group, actually. It just occurred to me in that little space between moving from the group to here, which is that Becky said something really, there was a tantalising thing about this resonating with people in their 40s and 50s. So people often with a kind of quite a senior level of responsibility somewhere. But then you said it also resonated with millennials as well. And I just wondered whether you wanted to say a bit more about whether there's generational things here.
Well, I think more what I wanted to say was that it's got a wider appeal than I first expected, because I'm a coach, and I was drawing a lot of my what I was noticing from people I coach, and I tend to coach people who are in senior positions, who therefore are sort of my kind of age and stage. What I realized was that this wasn't just a book about coaching. I mean, I even thought maybe it's a book about leadership. When I was developing the ideas, maybe it should be a book for leaders. And in the end, I was like, no, this is really a book for everyone. And I tested that with some of my younger clients, but then also with friends who are younger, and my friends' children who are younger still. And I think there are differences with generations, although I think they can sometimes be overstated. But I also think that what's really interesting is that it's not getting better for the younger generations, right? So younger people are still struggling with feeling that they're good enough and having too much to do and the digital boundary. So even though plenty of people may be digital natives, you know, the boundaries between when they're on and when they're not, or when they're available or when they're not, are still to be navigated. So I think that perhaps generations might experience these things slightly differently, but I think they are still as relevant for them. And I also think that that for many of us here, for example, may have been aware of the climate for a long time, the climate catastrophe and where we're at environmentally. I certainly have, since I did geography A level in 1985. But, you know, But I think that it's quite specific to the younger generation to have massive climate anxiety across that generation. So I think that there's a sort of different level of anxiety around that, which is, of course, fear-based, which, of course, then tips them into a mindset of scarcity, which is all the stuff we begin to then really explore in the book.
Who else? Pauline.
It's more an insight, not a question, but I really, when I read the book for the first chapter, I really resonate with the fear, especially like the FOMO. It's like the fear of missing out. I'm feeling I'm constantly in it. And you're definitely right, because in the world we're even living in now, like social media and everything make you think, oh, someone's life is much better. Why don't I have that? So yeah, I've really liked that. And also I really like what you shared earlier about this really help us to rethink how we live, because I generally do feel like after nearly 2 years of COVID, it really made me rethink how I want to live my life. And that's why I'm doing quite a lot of changes with my own life this year. So yeah, I'm quite looking forward to reading the rest of the book and knowing more about how I can help myself with this formal thing, which I still have.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much for sharing that, Pauline. And gosh, I am such a FOMO person. I love experiences and actually later in the book, I don't want to give it all away, but there's a love I quote in full because it's such a beautiful poem, a poem by a fellow called Michael Lunig, who's an Australian poet and cartoonist, called Jomo, which is the joy of missing out. So I'll just dangle that carrot for you, because it's a beautiful way of reframing that concept.
Can I say something else? So I don't want to dominate this. I think what I mentioned, and I think it's true probably for a lot of us who are in our 50s, is when I left school and university and whatever, I was basically told I could have it all. And I think that gave it its own pressure. You know, you were striving towards the next stage, the next stage, the next stage. And particularly I identified as a woman, it seemed to be this great new age where the women could be seen to achieve everything. And even once we had our families, we could still achieve everything and keep on going and going and going. And actually, I think we compromised a lot because we thought we could have it all. Whereas actually learning to have enough is such a, even saying it feels so much easier. Mm. And so much more a place of, I don't mean contentment from a sort of just sit back and relax, but just ease. It feels so much better. But I think as women, you know, I mean, I was the first female woman to make it to the position that I did and have a child and come back. You know, I was told when I was pregnant, you idiot. Mm. Because I'd seemed to have made a choice, but I came back and because I wanted to prove myself. Whereas the art enough isn't proving yourself at all. It's being from that place where you're happy, content and at ease with the whole thing. So I just love the title as well, that it's an art, not a science. And I love the tilted bit that we're still out of kilter a bit. We have to keep on reminding ourselves to straighten up a bit.
Yeah, I love the emphasis, I think, around the mindset and the sort of stories we tell ourselves, and this sort of it's a sense of I am enough feels quite important. And I was just showing my group when I had long COVID last year, there was something about the teaching that gave me, and just in a sense sort of surrendering to the fact that I didn't have to prove myself, or I didn't have to keep working, and just to let go. And that really helped me with that sense of that belief of I am enough. I suppose that for me just felt really important, the first chapter, that you emphasize the mindset, because that's a shift I think that needs to happen, but also the link you make to the planet and the climate, because you know, that to me is about a societal mindset shift as well. I'm just interested, I suppose how people have responded to the book, because that some people can take it at a very individual level, but there is something really important at that more planetary level, which and the way we we act in the world. I don't know, I'd be interested to know what the responses you had, how people have sort of, to me it's about the integration, but how people have responded across the whole spectrum that you've tried to offer, really, which I think has been really important.
Thanks, Liz. It's been a real range, I think, and of course I haven't spoken to everyone, but what people have said, I think people find, we find what we need in books that we read, don't we? And we zone in on the things that are helpful to us at the time. And this has, it is quite broad, because what I was trying to do was move between the sort of personal systemic, our internal systems, and then our sort of context systems, and then the world that we live in. And so I'm deliberately trying to sort of offer a lens which is really micro and really macro, without becoming too sort of abstract or preachy. And that was actually the last two chapters, when we get to them, were the hardest to write, because it's so hard to write about this stuff without saying, but for goodness sake, let's just stop doing, you know, or you know, being in any way sort of preachy. So I was really trying to make sure that it could always connect back to us as on an individual level. Yeah. But I really feel that, I mean, actually the responses I've had is people say, oh my goodness, chapter 4 was the one that did it for me, or chapter 2, I really needed to work. So where people need to do the work is where they'll be drawn to, of course.
And then out there, I suppose, like the activists, and then get burnt out, and you have to then do that inner work, and vice versa, as you do that inner work, that takes you out, isn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that, maybe this is too broad to think. Actually, it's something that I learned from someone that Claire and I both know. We both did some training with a guy called John Whittington. And what I learned from him was that it's often the vocational work, people who work in vocational contexts, whether that be faith or charities or big activist organizations, who struggle with boundaries, with boundaries of the on themselves of work, who give too much, because there's always more that you can give, that there's never enough in a way, because you can't really attend to the, you can't make it all better. And that energy, that activist energy, which is so necessary and important and wonderful, actually really needs a boundary in order to be healthy. So and then that tips you right back to chapter 1.
Yeah,
exactly. And then, so it's a big old cycle.
Yeah, thanks, Becky.
How do we rebalance the fact that we're over consuming the world's resources? And the theme of enough seemed to sort of hold all of those things together. And it seems to me that that is an art. It's not a science. It's not it's not an exact thing. And I like the idea of an art, because I take quite a lot of my images and metaphors from nature, and the idea of something, it seemed too dynamic. An art sort of allows for the dynamic nature of things, and it also allows for it to be completely individual. So my art of enough isn't your art of enough, or any of our art of enough. It's creative and individual for each of us. And it's sort of a balancing of dynamism. So I always liken it with trying to stand on one leg. You know, it's a sort of moving state. You can't stand on one leg and be still. You're constantly adjusting, and each of us will do that in our own way. So that's why. And of course, I liked the alliteration of it too.
Yeah, it has a nice flow.
And I'm noticing this, and to me, there's a sort of dance about it.
For me, there is too. When I'm describing it, it feels like it's this sort of nebulous or moving thing. And I think that there's something very 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 dynamic about it. It's a movement. And creative too, I think, actually. Once we find it, it's actually a lovely creative pursuit.
Yeah, I'm thinking about ebb and flow, which is what you're really describing there, isn't it?
Yeah. And there are lots of, I did it's really interesting because when I was talking to this commissioning editor who liked it and said, oh, I just don't like the title because I don't like the word enough. And I can sort of see what she means, because there are some ways that enough is sort of synonymous with mediocrity or sort of lack of stretch or lack of aspiration. And so when she was talking about that, I was sort of thinking about balance or equilibrium or other things. But in the end, I wanted to stick with enough because I kind of want to reclaim it as a concept that people feel is adequate, you know, that being adequate is on in and of itself something worth striving for, that enough is a state from which we can flourish, a sort of seedbed state, as opposed to this sort of sense of arrival or this sense of you know, being amazing and being bigger and stronger and greater. It's sort of like going, actually, if we can get to this place of balance or enough as a concept where we feel that it's something worth working on, then we'll be able to blossom from that place. And it's a different way of seeing the world, really.
Thank you, Becky. I think for me, the reason why I'm here is I've got to have some words with my inner critic. She's kind of raging at me. And the key message is, but is that enough? So it's like perfectionism. And so what I really want to do is use the book, for me personally, is to really kind of write, okay, let's dance around this and let's get to some resolution, because we're falling out, because she's pushing me to do all sorts of crazy things. And I'm thinking, yeah, I'm not having that. So for me, that's where I'm sort of drawing from. It's like, right, let's pull it personally into Art of Enough. And then I want to take it into my organizational context, which asks that question like, okay, what is enough here organizationally? Because we've all got to run a marathon. So I guess it's not a question. I'm just letting you know that my inner critic, we're going to, you know, use your book to have words.
Okay. Well, hi, Josephine. Hi, inner critic. And all I'd suggest is it's less about shutting her up. It's more about offering other people a voice. So she's not the only voice in your head. Invite some more and see if they can they can have a little bit more influence over your thinking too.
Thank you.
I call it the curse of perfectionism, by the way. I think perfectionism is an absolute, because you ought always come from a position of lack. You always fail. You fail before you've begun. So reframing that will be, there is some stuff in the book about that. So I hope that's useful.
Becky, how did you come up with the various arts, the seven that are listed?
It's a great question, and I don't really know. I like seven. I like the number seven. It's a good number.
It's a special number.
Yeah, like three, right? So yeah. I've got that, yeah. So, I wanted there to be seven, I think. I wanted there to be, I always knew that this was an inside out journey. So I knew that I wanted to start with the inside, how to be enough. I knew that the next bit was doing enough. And I knew that the next bit was having enough, and that would be a sort of deliberate build. So you're starting from the innermost work, then doing the stuff around how we relate to our immediate world, and then we do the stuff around how we relate to the wider world, so the letter thing. And I wasn't quite sure how I was going to distribute those, but when I was sort of brainstorming it, and I did lots of my early work with post-it notes and took all my pictures down off the wall and did lots of post-it notes and pictures and picturing, it just seemed to me that there were three at the beginning, that the three inner, the three arts, the mindset, the permission, the presence was the sort of bedrock. And then there was stuff around boundaries and stuff around resourcing, and then stuff around for the having enough stuff around growth and stuff around connection, which actually circles it right back. So I guess it was a process of, like all writing, it's actually a processing of editing down, isn't it? So for me, it's a process of editing down. I must have written as many words that I did that aren't in this book as there are in the book.
And then you decided that it was enough?
Yeah, full stop, end, go. Yeah.
And enough is enough, right?
Yes. I mean, it's a really, really interesting one because I can really appreciate those visual artists who say, you know, constantly keep sort of dabbing at their painting. But actually there is something, I think, which is, okay, look, this is good enough. There are plenty of things that I could change about it. Even now when I reread it, I can think, oh gosh, I could rewrite that. But actually I had to stop it somewhere and I had to go, right, okay, time to send it out to the world and see what happens. You know, I spent the beginning of this year reading it for Audible, which was just a real treat. And I was slightly nervous as I was driving to the studio as to whether I'd still like it. What if I think it's rubbish? And luckily I didn't think it was rubbish, and nor was I completely tormented by a critical voice while I was reading it. I was like, okay, well, you know, of course there are some things I might change now, but actually it is enough. And I think that there does come a point in any creative pursuit where you just have to say, that's it, until someone commissions me to do a second edition. I'll have to go back.
Or maybe you just write a new book.
Yeah, exactly. That would be nicer.
Yeah, just, well, and again, it's a comment rather than a question, I guess. And it's something about what attracted me. I've only just started reading the book, Becky, so I don't have kind of questions on the content. But I just really love this way that you make connection between being, doing and having, which just is a bit of a light bulb thing, really. I mean, it's obvious they're connected, but the way you explore that. And then the connection, you know, that sort of feels so relevant sort of on a personal level. And then the connectivity between the internal, the external, the community and the wider world, and just realizing it's a sort of ripples in the ocean thing. That's just starting with that being, then impacting the doing, and then impacting the having, and the way that little ripple could then impact and interconnect with the whole world. I just think it's really profound, and I look forward to reading more, and that's what drew me in.
Thank you, Susie. It's that Gaia concept, isn't it? It's the a butterfly flaps its wings in South America and creates a hurricane in somewhere else. So it's those small systemic changes that we make, which I really believe is true, actually. So it does start from ourselves.
And that's where the hope comes, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think it's really, I think it's really fundamental, actually. I think there's something about this which is just going back to the natural rhythms of life.
Yeah.
So the murmuration, yes. I mean, I love the idea of the murmuration being held in coherence by three rules. You know, I write about it in the book, but, you know, and if we can find three rules for us to keep us coherent by the same token, it's that sort of, it's using that rhythm, but also that we already have our own rhythm of life. You know, we already have a diurnal pattern. Our nervous system already has a rest and digest bit and a sort of heightened, you know, we've got parasympathetic and sympathetic stuff going on. And, you know, we need sleep, we need to recover, we need to rejuvenate. And I really think that what's happened in our society and our culture, and certainly in the working lives of people that I work with, including me, I've just sort of got out of rhythm with that pattern, or even worse, disregard it, sort of trample on it. So this image that I have of everything in the life being cyclical, but if it gets so overextended, it sort of cranks itself into a line, and then it does risk running out. You know, we're at a state in the world, in the planet, where we've over-consumed so much that we are actually threatening the very cycle of life's resources. And the same, I think, with ourselves. You know, the fact that we use the term burnout, yeah. You know, it's you know, people reach the end of themselves. You know, it's really like, and actually we're beautifully designed to be nice and cyclical and to regenerate, and it sort of feels so fundamental to me.
That's really interesting, isn't it, how we use words, how you use phrases. Oh, I'm at the end of my tether. I'm at the end of, yeah, that's really interesting. Mm. Or run out.
So I want to ask why we choose to say that more is enough, or more is better. Now, this may be American society. I don't know about British English society, but we buy the concept that more is better. Mm. More is not enough. We never have enough. We're always trying to get more. And if you're not going up the ladder, you're going down the ladder. And that's not good. Mm. So why? I'm trying to ask a why question. Mm. And you didn't address that in the book necessarily, but why do we buy that?
I do a little bit of addressing it in the book, but it's such a big subject. Okay. And there's plenty written about it. But there is, in my chapter on growth, it's when I get the most meta, if you like. And there is a school of thought that the American economy, post-World War II, deliberately created designed obsolescence in order to regenerate the economy. So that deliberately they would make, manufacturers would make stuff that would run out, that people mm-hmm. would need to buy, that would get thrown away. So you buy, you know, you create a cycle of depletion so that you constantly need more. And in order to create that, you have to create a culture of scarcity, and you have to create a comparative culture where everyone feels like they have, that you literally, it's in the ether that people don't have enough. And you start measuring. Everything began to be measured by GDP growth, which is sort of this idea of exponential growth. And anyone, as soon as you start, if you really look at the concept of exponential economic growth, even the most sort of neoliberal economist will tell you it's impossible. You can't. It's impossible. There is an end point. But it's become mythologized and sort of incorporated into how we see the world. And I think it's fundamentally flawed because it's only looking at one thing. And of course, the cost is very high. And I'm not talking about the economic cost. I'm talking about the personal human cost and, of course, the cost of the planet. And so I think there is a huge rebalancing that has to happen. And I quote a lot, a fantastic economist called Kate Raworth, who's written a book called Donut Economics, and she explains it far better than I could ever do, but I recommend her work. Because it's just, again, it's this myth that underlines this sort of sense that more is better, which is taking us all to the end of ourselves. And actually, we're using more than we physically can use. You know, I think there's something like, if everyone, there are all sorts of analogies, like, you know, we throw away so much stuff that soon we've got more stuff on the planet, and we need enough for seven planets to accommodate the amount of stuff we've got, and we haven't got seven planets, so how are we going to manage that? So I think there is something, David, about our mindset. And I think it's there very strongly in the States, but I think it's absolutely here in Europe too. Mm-hmm. You know, I actually think it's sort of part of how capitalism works. And I don't quite know how we can, mm-hmm. how we can make, environment, there are lots of environmental capitalists or people who are really, really looking at this, which is how can we continue to feel like we're growing without it always being more or bigger or better? That growth, mm-hmm. how can we begin to look at growth in new ways? And yeah. I sort of pose that as a question, but it's such a huge philosophical and
maybe that's your next book, Is More Better?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think
or,
there are
or
pretty,
more is not better.
Yeah, less is more. I have just read a really good book called Less Is More, actually. There's a, yeah, I mean, yes. there are pretty good, there's pretty good books out there on it, but I think at its heart, we have to, I think at its heart, we have to turn that on its head and say, you know, more things aren't always better, and more experiences, but more love would be good, or more connection mm-hmm. is lovely. You know, there are ways that we can have more of sure. things without them being damaging.
Yeah.
Oliver Berkman comes at it from the psychologist perspective. He's just written a book called 4,000 Weeks, which is
just read
actually
it. Yeah.
It's an amazing book. Mm. But he talks about the idea of the bucket list, and a bucket list is I want to gather more and more experiences. But he's done psychological research that says if you do that, you actually don't enjoy them, because what you're doing is you're acquiring items on your bucket list rather than immersing yourself in experiences. So this, the murmuration thing, there's one that starts right outside our house. And I'll tell you, that's better than a holiday in all sorts of amazing places. And every morning it happens 30 minutes before the sunrise. Gorgeous. And it is the most extraordinary experience. And I would never have thought that would be a bucket list thing. But it's something I can experience every day, although not in the summer. Too early. But actually, there's something about appreciating that because you can be very present to it. And I did take a video the other day, but not until I'd kind of watched it naturally, probably 10, 12, 15 times. And then I wanted to show my husband because he wasn't up. So I took a little video of it. But one of the things Oliver Berkman says is that, you know, we run around the world with a camera. But how do we appreciate and how do we live in the present moment?
There's something about that mindset of being consumers. And I rail against that, but I behave like that. And we can be consumers of so many things, like we can be consumers of training or consumers of academic qualifications or whatever it is.
And I think that the concept of consumption, you know, it's like the very hungry caterpillar, isn't it? It's that concept of consumption, that there's never enough. And it immediately, if you're coming at things from a state of feeling that you lack something, then we sort of buy something to compensate for it, compensate for that lack. And of course, it never fills the need. It's the hungry ghost in Buddhism. They call it the hungry ghost, don't they? And which is why the state of being enough, or the ability to be enough, is a different thing. So if you choose to buy something from a state of enough, then you choose to buy something because it's either necessary or beautiful. You know, it's that lovely Marie Kondo thing, you know, spark joy movement that I talk about in the book, because I just love the idea that we have things because either they're really useful or they bring us joy. Anything else?
That was the Quaker ethos, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Have nothing in your home except that which is useful or brings you joy.
Yeah, lovely.
Yeah.
It's a cheeky one. What's the next book?
More than enough. No. I don't know. I have been really thinking. I don't know is the honest answer. I was sort of thinking one of the bits of feedback I've had about the book is that it's lots of books in one book. And I really see that. It's a really broad book, and each chapter could, there are books on each chapter in the world already. So I wondered whether the next book would be an expansion of one of the things in one of the chapters, but I can't decide which one, and I'm not entirely sure what that'll be. So I don't know yet. I haven't started it. I'm just focusing on this thing for now.
So this begins our journey in the 3D book group, and it's been great to have you here. If you don't yet have a copy, chapter one is freely available in the show notes. Each week we're going to be looking at a new chapter. There'll be a post on Twitter, on Facebook and LinkedIn in the 3D coaching accounts. Again, details in the show notes. Or you can email info@3dcoaching.com to share your comments with your insights and questions for this week's chapter. Then Becky's going to record a short podcast each week responding to what you've said. You can join in at any time. So if you're listening to this podcast, it's never too late to start because you've always got enough time. Just search on LinkedIn, Twitter and Facebook for #3dbookgroup. So thank you all for coming, and thank you, Becky, for sharing your story and your journey and what's enough.
You're welcome, and I really look forward to travelling this with you and hearing what you think and your questions. And I'm really, really thrilled that you're here and excited to explore it with you.
If you've enjoyed what you've heard today, we'd love you to share the podcast with a friend or leave a comment on social media. And if you'd like to become a regular at The Coaching Inn, you can subscribe on Podbean and all major podcast channels. We look forward to welcoming you next time. You've been listening to The Coaching Inn, 3D Coaching's virtual pub. For more information, check out 3dcoaching.com.